passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When Ryan says when it's time to begin, it's on the Rewind to Ride with John Pollock and Waiting the A-Team that makes sense of these things we see in the ring every week on TV. It's Rewind to Ride for Monday night, download it Tuesday morning from the Post Wrestling site. It's Rewind to Ride for Monday night on USA Now on the John and Wade Take the Mic.
Welcome to Rewind to Raw. I'm John Pollock, joined by Waiting, who is alive. Hello, Wei.
I'm very much alive. Yes, that I am. As are you.
As Edwin said, ain't it good to be alive?
Oh, that might be a bit more of an obscure reference. I don't know how many people outside of this city of a certain age would remember that song.
That's like a 20-year cut, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how popular it really was. I mean, you're talking about CanCon at this point, you know?
Well, you know, for the people out there who saw the biggest problems in life being that if we could only just have one more astronaut,
that would be the solution.
It's all tied together. How are you doing? How was your Monday? Good?
Yeah, not bad. No, it was a great day outside. So, you know, carried on a bit of that momentum from yesterday and decided to go for a nice long walk. And, man, I'm tired. I was, like, pretty exhausted, but certainly by the first hour of this show, I was feeling it. But, yeah, we've been enjoying some really great weather in the city right now.
Yep, we're about due for a snowstorm, so that our luck will run out soon. It was mid-May last year. We did get snow, so I'm hoping for it, to be honest.
Well, like, I've had my winter jacket out, like, for, like, all these months. I'm waiting to just put it back in, but I'm really unsure. So I just have like jackets on top of jackets right now. I got my spring jacket, my other spring jacket, and a, you know, so please just make up your mind, Mother Nature.
It's tough. We live in a very indecisive country when it comes to seasonal change, but we'll keep everyone posted. I know that they're always curious, those outside of the GTA. What is the weather situation like? I want to hear John and Wei talk about the weather.
Do you have any issues with allergies, seasonal allergies?
It's funny. I used to and have not.
Wow. You're so lucky.
Yeah.
Maybe
like this year and last year. And I do wonder if any of that is somewhat pandemic related.
I was wondering if my allergies are worse because I've been indoors so often. I don't know. But they were really tough this year. And I actually was just alerted that it might be due to global warming. Might have something to do with that.
Oh, okay.
Delayed pollination or longer pollination, but you're lucky. Like I've had the opposite of you, where I've grown up for most of my life not feeling anything, and you know, in recent years it's gotten really bad. But I grew up
and I did not have them, and then it was in my 20s. Usually every spring I get them bad for 3 weeks or so, but definitely I didn't get it last year, and I don't know if it goes back further than that. But yeah, this year nothing, not a thing.
Okay, well let's hope that keeps up.
So good luck on that battle.
Yes. I think I'll be okay.
Well, I hope you're going to be well this week, because on Thursday you will be joined by Jordan Goodman live at 3 p.m. and you guys have a big guest this Thursday.
Yeah, once a month, Jordan Goodman and I are joined by the entire post-wrestling community on Patreon, postwrestlingcafe.com, as we bring you the Wellness Policy. And this week, we actually have our very first guest on the Wellness Policy, officially. His name is David Speed, and some of you may have recognized his work. He is a really talented street artist. Some of you may have remembered when Brody Lee passed, there's this wonderful mural that was posted on Reddit and made the rounds. And this person happens to be a big wrestling fan, obviously. But, you know, he also hosts a podcast about creativity. So we wanted to bring him on to talk about creativity. So if you have any interest in the topic or just, you know, want to check out the Wellness Policy, if you're a patron, tune in live 3 p.m. Eastern at postwrestlingcafe.com on Thursday. But as always, it'll be free for all for everybody afterwards on the free feed.
Yeah, we've got that show on Friday. We're going to have a new Rewind Away where we are going to be reviewing TNA Unbreakable from 2005 inside the Impact Zone, featuring one of the most remembered main events in TNA history with Christopher Daniels, Samoa Joe, and AJ Styles fighting for the X Division Championship. And we will rewind 16 years to TNA in 2005, just weeks before they would launch on Spike TV. And what a show we have to review, which we will be reviewing on Impact Plus.
Yeah, we'll speak a bit about it, the Impact Plus experience, perhaps.
You know what, my early... I'll save it for the show.
Oh, okay.
I have a bad habit of doing that, where I talk about things on shows that are disconnected from the show that it makes more sense for it to be discussed on. So I'm going to hold off on that.
No, you can give it away right now.
No,
John.
No.
We'll just cut off the ending with some sort of like screwy, you know, so a trombone will play in the background. Therefore, people will have incentive to pay to check it out at a later time.
There you go. You want to get into this head? $6 a month. It's the least. It's a bargain, folks. So Rewind Away this Friday. We'll have a post-pro-res this weekend with WH and Dylan. It's not a crazy week. This is not an insane week, which I don't mind. I can take these really packed weekends, and then we get offset with like some calmer ones like coming up this weekend. Because this weekend, given that there's not a whole lot going on, I'm going to hope to watch that Hana Kimura tribute show that's going to be on Sunday. It's going to be on Sunday night on Fight. So, and it will have English commentary. So I'm going to probably check that out on Sunday, which would have been tough if it was a weekend where there's 10,000 events going on.
More time to enjoy the weather.
That's true. That's true. All right. The whole schedule is up at postwrestling.com. Check that out. If you are just listening right moments after Raw, like, wow, they're live. Raw was just on. I want more. Well, you can get us live, folks. Monday night, Wednesday night, Friday night, after Dynamite, after SmackDown. It's the key to your wrestling fandom.
It is possible to become a patron to listen to these right after these shows end, but I think more and more people are just not watching the shows at all and just listening. So you could do that too, if you choose.
Whatever you so choose. And it's hard to get a gauge over the last few days because Showbuzz Daily has created a giant hole in the wrestling community.
What's been happening? Yeah.
Showbuzz Daily is on life support.
Like Showbuzz Daily, I know, like, you know, websites can be somewhat problematic, but come on, like, how long has this been? It's almost been a week now that this whole thing is down.
It's been down since Thursday.
Are you telling me there are no other ways you could deliver these graphs and spreadsheets? Come on, you've not heard of Facebook? Why not just like screen cap the thing and put the thing up there? Or Google Drive? Dropbox?
There's multiple ways of distributing such information, but Showbuzz Daily, it's
Weekly soon.
I mean, maybe it was just, you know what they couldn't handle? They couldn't handle AEW putting that graphic up on Wednesday. It was just they weren't ready.
That's what crashed the site. Yeah,
that's it. So anyway, let's go into a couple news stories. And starting off, the unfortunate news, the passing of Don Kernodle at the age of 71. This news came out on Monday. And Don Kernodle, younger fans might not be familiar as much with his body of work. He was, a pretty successful figure in the Mid-Atlantic territory. He started his career in the early 70s and then rose up, and he was part of Sergeant Slaughter's Cobra Corps, and he was teaming with Private Jim Nelson, who would later become Boris Zhukov of the Bolsheviks. And after that team dissolved, the more famous team is Don Kernodle and Sergeant Slaughter. And together, they would win the NWA World Tag Team Championship and had one of, if not the biggest matches in the history of the Carolinas with Jay Youngblood and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, where they were the babyface tag team chasing after the titles, and it built up to March the 12th of 1983, and this was billed as the final conflict. It was Steamboat and Youngblood's last opportunity at the tag titles, and it's kind of amazing to recap this, given we just saw this stipulation on SmackDown a few weeks ago with Daniel Bryan. Similar stipulation where, you know, he would have to leave the territory. This was, you know, their final chance at the titles. The difference was here in 1983, this was one of the most in-demand shows ever. Remember that Greensboro, North Carolina, it's very well known to wrestling fans because of Jim Crockett Promotions. It's a very small city when you're comparing it to other major territories and the metropolitan area. This is a city of about 150,000. And they drew a sellout at the Greensboro Coliseum for this match, which was over 16,000. And they turned away thousands of people. I believe the figure was somewhere around 6,000 people that tried and could not get into this. So it was an enormous card. They were the headliner. There was also a match with Ric Flair and Greg Valentine. But the cage match went on last, and Youngblood and Steamboat won the titles. And while it was the final conflict, they did take the match to all the different cities, including Toronto, because this is when Mid-Atlantic and the Tunnies had a working relationship, and they would come up here on Sundays. So it was an enormous match, so big that this was largely the impetus behind Starrcade later that year to run a major event on Thanksgiving night, which was a traditional big wrestling night in the territory going back to the early 60s. But it was this match, this demand, that led to Starrcade and having, you know, a small level of closed circuit locations on top of it. And, you know, you could go into the history of Starrcade, but this match really kind of lit that fuse when Dory Funk Jr. was the head booker in the company. After losing that match, that's when Slaughter would go to the World Wrestling Federation. Kernodle himself would work with the WWF throughout 1983, but would return and wrestle in Jim Crockett Promotions. He would later team with Ivan Koloff and Nikita Koloff before they did a big angle to kick Kernodle out of the group. And then he would team with his brother Rocky Kernodle up until, you know, he wound down his days in the ring, and then did some dates in Puerto Rico earlier in his career, and then even into the early 90s, and then did some sporadic matches for the CWF Mid-Atlantic group up until 2006. Between 02 to 06, he did some matches here and there, but that was, I think when you say Don Kernodle, you're most going to associate him with the team with Sergeant Slaughter and that March 12th, 1983 date. A very important match in the Carolinas, and by extension, what it contributed to in terms of Starrcade and building to these big annual events as they moved more into, you know, what would eventually become the pay-per-views that the company would run.
Yeah, a figure that's very much before my time, but sounded like he had an incredibly storied career. How old was he?
He was 71. So other news items today. New Japan has announced that they're going to be resuming shows beginning on May the 22nd. So coming up later this week in Nagoya, followed by three straight nights at Core Q and Hall next week. And, you know, they won't be doing that Tokyo Dome show, which when I was looking at the schedule, Wei, do you realize that had that Tokyo Dome show gone ahead, we would have had SmackDown on the Friday night of the 28th, followed by Dynamite at 10 with the Tokyo Dome several hours later, early Saturday morning.
Wow. We narrowly avoided catastrophe.
I'm not missing that Tokyo Dome show not happening on the 29th. So that's, we can do that later in the year, but New Japan basically getting back to their schedule. As is Ring of Honor, who have announced their Best in the World pay-per-view will be Sunday, July the 11th. So an interesting move that they're going from Friday night pay-per-views to Sunday night pay-per-views in Baltimore, clearly wanting to avoid the Rewind to SmackDown conflict. So a smart move on their part. And this show in Baltimore is going to have limited capacity. They will have pods set up to a maximum of 6 people per pod with social distancing of 6 feet between each group. Temperatures will be taken. Masks must be worn. So I would say like a much more careful approach being taken by Ring of Honor than, you know, some other companies that we have, like whether it be the UFC or like it just seems like they are going back into this. But we already knew that in Maryland, they have had very, very strict protocols that ROH has followed. And this looks to be the acknowledgement that fans can be here, but also putting a lot of protocols in place. And this is what so many the NFL is going through this right now, where it's kind of unknown what are the protocols going to be, because they expect full capacity stadiums this fall when the NFL resumes, and what's going to be the protocols in place, and right down to, are they going to require proof of people to show that they are vaccinated? That's a whole area that's being explored now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like ROH has, you know, been incredibly careful throughout this entire pandemic, and that continues even up until this point, where it feels like so many places are just going back to normal, or maybe not really kind of like figuring the effort required to keep up with something like contact tracing even. But yeah, we have to commend ROH for continuing to, you know, keep these keep safety. It's first priority by a big margin.
Yeah, they've really been at the forefront, I think, when you look at this past year. This is just a major media story. And I mean, there is some, you know, trickle down to all of this, but that may not be realized for a while. And that is AT&T announcing that they are going to essentially merge together Warner Media and Discovery. This is a $43 billion deal. And of course, Warner Media, that encompasses TNT, but more importantly, Turner Sports, and how that figures into all of this. This is just a gigantic, media deal. And this merger is going to make this combination larger than Netflix and NBC Universal, be the second largest media company in the world behind Disney. Now, this deal is not expected to close until the middle of 2022 because they have to go through regulatory approval, shareholder approval. But anyway, this is just a big, major worldwide story today. But somewhere in all of that is TNT, to see what all of this means and, you know, their overall strategy as it relates. I would say to their sports portfolio is a significant one in the Warner Media business.
I believe technically it is a new company being created with the two entities rather than AT&T strictly merging, for instance. But it's
right. Like it's like essentially putting Warner Media with Discovery.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like the result that might possibly trickle down to AEW won't be felt for a long, long time, if at all. You know, like AEW and really even TNT is probably just going to be a very small portion of this entire portfolio, which encompasses HBO and, man, anything like CNN. And, you know, the DC universe, I suppose, you know, like movies, you know, we're talking. So I really don't know at what point, you know, it'll affect everything, of course. You know, this is a really big story, but
will zombies be involved?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of room for cross promotion, of course. Yeah. Zack Snyder is that it's Warner movie? I don't know. I don't know where he produced it. But, you know, it continues to maybe offer more opportunity for synergy, I suppose, if you're talking about the future for AEW being teamed up with, you know, TV people in Discovery that might be able to handle their sort of product with a bit more insight, you would hope.
And then quickly, we've got NXT on Tuesday that they've announced Johnny Gargano and Bronson Reed in the steel cage match for the North American title, Zoe Stark versus Toni Storm, and an interview with Pete Dunne. And I thought we got more than our usual hype for NXT on tonight's Raw, where instead of just your generic commercial, they had promos cut by Reed and Gargano with like the old school behind the fence for the cage match build up. I thought it was a much more effective way to promote a big match than what we usually get for NXT, which is a very dry promotion. That's just a commercial.
I sense that too. Yeah. I mean, once NXT moved to Tuesdays, I think we had all wondered how much more cross promotion you might see for the show being directly following Raw the next night. And I don't really know if you saw the full effect of that. Certainly not to the level that you maybe saw tonight. So it's good for NXT. And these are some pretty good commercials too. You know,
big comic book poster for the match as well.
Yeah, they weren't simply like, this match is happening, here's a matchup board. Like to be honest, it kind of blew away anything on tonight's show, like the promos and like the card even for NXT tomorrow. Definitely blows away anything on tonight's show.
They didn't explain if any musical instruments could come into play though during the cage match.
Well, it's not a soundproof cage, is it?
It's what these wrestlers need, noise-canceling headphones. Preferably wireless. And then AEW on Wednesday, their updated lineup, they've added a few matches. It's the Young Bucks against the Varsity Blondes for the tag titles, Serena Deeb versus Red Velvet for the NWA women's title, Moxley and Kingston against the Acclaimed, Christian Cage versus Matt Sydal, Anthony Ogogo versus Austin Gunn, and Hikaru Shida versus Rebel. Not Reba.
All right. Yes. Cool.
Shawn Michaels, A&E biography. Did you get to see it?
I did get to see it. Yeah.
What did you think just overall in terms of, with Shawn Michaels, I think that they went into a lot of areas that I kind of expected them to. It's always interesting when they, like in WWE in particular, their code words for a lot of this stuff, it's demons and partying. But they did get more specific in this.
I felt like they didn't really kind of rely on the code words too much. I mean, Shawn Michaels was very blunt about doing a lot of blow slash yayo, which
yayo.
He often say, which I thought was awesome.
And Continental would get his $100 payoff where he could get $50 and then $50 in blow that 9 times out of 10, he would take them up on that exchange.
We even had like the, I guess stock footage of like lines of coke being divvied up, like you would see, and then like superimposed over top of it.
So it's always great when they can dig into the stock footage.
I felt like this was the best one they've done. It to me
really?
Presented, yeah. Well, I think it's kind of slim pickings, honestly, about like what else there is. But of the A&E biographies, I like this one the most. I thought it presented what felt like a pretty honest, yet obviously very abridged look at Shawn's past faults and subsequent transformation.
They tried to cover a lot in the 2 hours. Like they, it's a pretty expansive career and they did try to hit on everything. I like the Montreal stuff. I'm not even going to get into like,
it wasn't overbearing.
No, it wasn't. Like they kept it short. It's still the old, whatever, like you can get into your philosophy behind all of it, but I like that they kept it relatively small in the whole thing. I mean, it was what, 5-6 minutes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, and when you think about the context of his entire career, that is not an incident that necessarily defines him. I imagine for Brett, it'll probably take a bit more time because I think, unfortunately, it seems to define Brett a whole lot more than it seems to define Shawn. But I felt like there was some pretty good coverage of all the major incidents in his career. You have to remember these A&E biographies, they're not necessarily like a Dark Side of the Ring that kind of like tries to investigate a specific incident. This is more just a general Wikipedia overview of the main events of this person's career to somebody who might be familiar with Shawn but doesn't know all this stuff. Or maybe somebody who doesn't know who Shawn Michaels is whatsoever. In 90 minutes, you can know, okay, what is the barbershop window? What is Syracuse? What is losing your smile? You know, they covered all these things, I thought, like, in pretty succinct and, like, pretty good fashion. I didn't feel like there were any kind of, like, crazy selections of talking heads in this one like there was in previous episodes. Felt like everybody who was chosen for the show was a relevant voice.
Yeah, I thought you got some, you know, one of the like main things you come out of this, it's, I don't want to say necessarily sorrow, but it's it's like somewhat you just feel sad that this guy had, like, he very much is open about the fact that in his career, like the first half of his career, it's literally all this guy has. It's just, he comes up from like a very, like, doesn't have like a problem upbringing, has a wonderful family, but he gets into this industry and finds success immediately. Like, he's in Mid-South. That's his first territory at 19. And by 21, like, he's gone to Kansas City in Central States. He's on ESPN for the AWA at 21. Like, he's just rising up very quickly. And then he gets almost immediately, he's into the pills, he's into the partying, and he's so dependent on it. And it just, he had no life outside of pro wrestling. And it just seemed like a very hollow existence that he lived that only escalated as his talents grew, his exposure grew, and his bank account grew at such a high level. But this was a very empty human being until the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Something I don't often think about when it comes to like Shawn Michaels and his championship run in the mid 90s is that, like, I mean, people often talk about Kevin Nash being a poorly drawn champion, but I mean, in many ways, I felt Shawn was, you know, kind of admittedly here like a failed champion with the company, not really able to kind of handle that sort of weight on his shoulders, and even reluctant to, you know, give it up by the end. He is a great in-ring performer, and I think we all, like, love the 90s Shawn Michaels. But, I mean, certainly mentally, this really highlighted that he was not ready for that spot and ended up, you know, retiring, I mean, because of his body. But, you know, you have to wonder how much, like, his lifestyle and everything else would have played into his early retirement at the age of 33.
I think you have to just throw it out there that had he not had that back injury, was he going to make it? I think that's a very relevant question to ask, because this is a guy that was spiraling. Like, it sounded very much like the final days of Brian Pillman. Like, that's how dark this guy's life was getting by 97, early 98, and is just living off of pills. His body is breaking down. Like, remember, at the time he walks away in 98, he's 32 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Which is right around the same age Pillman has the Humvee wreck. Like, it's, you're talking about very young athletes that are facing like the rest of their lives potentially, and their bodies are breaking down and obviously would have completely different outcomes. But that's what Shawn is facing. Here's a guy that is dependent on prescription drugs. His body is breaking down and his future is looking very bleak in 1998.
Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, the documentary really highlighted how much of a personal caregiver Triple H was for him during those periods, with Hunter specifically saying, like, part of his routine every night was to make sure that Shawn would get up to his hotel room. He would, like, make sure that, like, he put him into bed and then set his alarm for every few hours to check on him to make sure that he wasn't dead, basically. And that really kind of shows you how alarming his state was. And to be given that level of responsibility in a company at a time when the man can barely be helped to, like, be kept alive, I think is pretty... Here's the thing is, like, I wasn't sure how much they were going to go into all of this, because it's one thing for, you know, let's say Savage, you know, to, like, be high on an episode of Nitro. But this is WWE and their world champion in this state on their own watch. And, you know, you kind of have to, like, they don't place blame on Vince, like, and they don't place blame on the company.
Vince literally has that line where he said he was okay once in our environment, he was protected. It was outside of our environment. Like, what does that mean? Because this guy is a mess. And you go back to the Dark Side of the Ring episode, and what is it that Brian Pillman is his breaking point in his relationship with Jim Ross? It's when they are so concerned with him that they put him through a drug test, rightfully so. But his argument was, I'm hardly the only guy that's a mess here. And when you have Shawn that you are sharing a locker room with, I can see that double standard and being furious that I'm being singled out, whereas Shawn is, in theory, getting a free pass that the locker room is seeing, because this guy is falling apart as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I felt like, you know, you kind of have to draw your own conclusions, but I felt like it pointed the finger at a WWE work environment a lot more than maybe some of the other documentaries have thus far in this A&E series. But, you know, because this has such a strong redemptive story, perhaps they feel willing to be able to go into that territory, because the second half of his career, of course, is, you know, like, I mean, it's arguably better than his first, I think many people say. And certainly he does appear to be a very different person than he was the first time. And then it kind of gets into like even the third stage of his career at this point now, where you get to see a lot of backstage footage of him working with NXT talent over the past year. And it really kind of makes it look like he is very much at peace and excited about what he's doing today at the Performance Center.
Yeah, you kind of get those kind of three different viewpoints of Shawn Michaels in his professional career, like the first run, the second run, and modern day. And, you know, it is a really remarkable story when you see it, because you look at Shawn through 98, 99, it's like it would be stunning to believe that this guy was going to make it to this degree. Like, it really is unbelievable what he was able to turn around, and deserves a lot of credit for that, to be able to drop that addiction that he had. I thought it was a pretty chilling comment that Paul Levesque shares of, whether it was meant seriously, half seriously, or in jest, was the remark Shawn made that had he just like overdosed on pills after WrestleMania 14, he would be viewed as a legend. Like, that's a pretty scary state of mind to be in. And I mean, they did kind of focus on that earlier in his career when him and Marty are fired immediately in 87 and they're down in Continental, and Shawn is messed up on all this stuff and he is contemplating suicide. Like, that is how much this guy was reliant on professional wrestling, and thinking that at the age of 22, my shot at the World Wrestling Federation was done and my career has peaked already in my early 20s, when he's 3 years into this.
Mm-hmm. When you consider all of that, and then you go on to see, you know, the great run he would have later on, and the ability to just strictly focus on the art and ignore the rest of that bullshit, like, it is a, you know, very heartwarming, enlightening story.
Did you find it interesting, the analysis that even today, Shawn acknowledging that his level of creativity and to get to a point of being fearless as a performer, he does not think he could have reached those heights without this reckless lifestyle. I found that to be really interesting, and probably like a very honest answer, that you look at a lot of quote unquote tortured artists, that is their, like, it is that element that it does produce art at the same time. And you know, he's saying like, I could not have reached this level to push myself without that at the same time. I found that to be very interesting and self-reflective.
It is interesting, yeah. You know, nobody would really know the answer to that except him. But certainly physically, I think, like, he would have been that either way. You know, would he have had the attitude that, you know, would have attracted people, maybe attracted Vince McMahon to put the belt on him and to make him the top guy? Well, who knows? I mean, certainly the Heartbreak Kid character seems like a very much an extension of, like, who the guy is. And if he was as mellow as he is today back then, wearing the camo hat, and the jeans, you know, would he be as over as he was in the 90s? I don't know.
What have you thought, seeing he's been in all of these A&E pieces? I've been disappointed with Vince McMahon, just that it's, you know, I don't know what his recollections are, how clear of a memory he has, but it's very basic stuff that Vince McMahon is providing. And I think for someone, you know, the level of notoriety of having Vince McMahon in your documentaries, it just feels like it's very surface level, like the most surface level. He, to me, if he wasn't Vince McMahon, this would be stuff I'd be cutting from the episode, to be honest.
Well, the issues introduced thus far, I would say, largely aren't necessarily confrontational to Vince himself. I'm trying to think, like, of the episodes that we've seen, how much of the finger was, like, did, you know, Vince have to answer for? It doesn't even get into it with the Montreal Screwjob here, because I think, I mean, they didn't even present his side, and
just his, you know, role his as, like, mediator slash, you know, provocator involving Brett and Sean. Like his, like he's in the midst of this, like essentially pulling the strings of these two very high strung individuals. I mean, there's a lot of interesting dynamics at play there. And I just think we're getting, you know, you just don't get much beyond surface level with Vince McMahon. And that just, to a further point, you look at the documentary series they're creating on Vince McMahon, how much of that is, I think people are so enamored with the idea of a documentary series on Vince McMahon with the belief that this guy has done and seen everything, but how much of that documentary series is going to be relied on other talking heads versus Vince McMahon himself? I don't know.
Well, I really have to imagine, because it's an entire series focused on the man, that you can't just talk about the highlights of the man's life. If you're doing a 90-minute show, I can understand doing something like, you know, what we saw with the Sean piece, which is very, you know, relatively surface level. Hey, here are the highlights of the man's career. Any sort of controversial aspect will kind of weave. Even with Sean, though, like they talk about the controversies in his life. And Vince McMahon is not somebody who has lived without any controversy, obviously. So in the span of an entire series, I would have to expect that you would get some of that, you know, warts and all type of presentation.
Yeah. Overall, I would say this. If you ever read Shawn Michaels' book, which came out about 15 years ago, you know, that's it's shortly after his comeback. We're only a few years into the return. You know, there's a lot of, you know, the same stuff covered in both. But this version of Shawn in the documentary, I think, is a much more grounded, reflective, taking ownership of his mistakes version. Because even in the book, which is, again, after his comeback, still very defensive, very much kept putting blame elsewhere. Does really comes off as someone that it's very rare that you read an autobiography where the person becomes unlikable at times, but he does in this book. Taking a lot of pot shots at Brett in the book, very dismissive of, you know, newsletter coverage of himself, pretty much any coverage of himself. It was pretty much he would talk about all the criticisms, like, you know, refusing to do jobs. He would say, there's no such thing as refusing to do a job. But then he'd always couch things with, did this happen? Yeah, but I was just trying to poke people. I was just trying to poke the bear. It was like he was acknowledging that he did these things, but, oh, it was just taken the wrong way. It just wore thin in the book for me, whereas this version, it feels like a much more mature Shawn Michaels.
Well, were there instances in this documentary where you felt like some of those things were answered in a different way? Like, for instance, the whole losing his smile bit. What was your kind of takeaway after watching this?
His story has always been the same, is that he went to a doctor in San Antonio, and his doctor, who I guess does not specialize with like athletes, which is a different, you know, type of analysis, like, you know, examining random person off the street versus high level, intense athlete, and saw that Shawn Michaels, he had no ACL left and he had been working without an ACL for years, and said, you can't ever wrestle again. And Shawn took this as gospel, got a second opinion after the losing my smile speech, which, I mean, Sean is a mess by this point in terms of the whole schedule and the drug use, but gets the second opinion from Dr. James Andrews, who is the guy that WWF sends all their people to, and just like, you can just wear a knee brace, you'll be fine. Like, you don't even need surgery. But there was so much to that. Of Sean was scheduled to lose to Brett at WrestleMania. It was a very convenient way out of WrestleMania, which you can argue was for the best for the company, because the backup plan ended up getting Austin that match with Brett that was of significant importance to the company. But I mean, Brett has just always believed like there was more at play than what Sean was alleging, but Sean stayed. I mean, it could be a case of both being true, that a doctor gave him this prognosis and that was a very convenient way out of this, of working that WrestleMania with Brett.
Yeah. The man has lived a very interesting life, and therefore I thought it made a pretty interesting 90 minutes here. It's not going to be as in-depth as something like a book. Or, you know, it's not going to focus on a specific issue like Montreal or Wrestling with Shadows. But, you know, for a concise 90 minutes, if you are Shawn Michaels fan and kind of want to relive his entire career in that span of time, or introduce him to somebody who doesn't really know Shawn, I thought it was really well done.
What did you think about how they covered the return in Saudi Arabia?
I don't think that exists.
WrestleMania 2010, my swan song, much like Ric Flair's was in WrestleMania 24 on this documentary as well. The final matches for each individual. But that was the Shawn Michaels A&E biography. And I guess next week is the main event with the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah. Judging by the previews, I mean, it does look like they will talk about the man's faults. We will see how they present them. And we'll see what sort of redemptive story that they're able to tell for Warrior.
All right, on to Raw, coming off of Night of the Zombies. Bobby Lashley was in the back with a group of women celebrating, not his sisters. And MVP introduced Bobby in the ring. He comes out and states that Braun Strowman has broken ribs and Drew McIntyre could not get out of bed this morning. Lashley did all of this while injured as he shows off his knuckles. And MVP offers an open challenge for Bobby Lashley tonight.
It was sort of a joke. He's saying he's injured. His knuckles were damaged from beating Drew and Braun up so badly.
So Drew comes out and Adnan Verk points out that Drew did not lose. It was Braun that was pinned. So we had Drew, we had Adnan Verk by way of Drew and Charlotte Flair essentially making the same arguments as a babyface and a heel that I was not beat.
That's why we had three ways, wasn't it?
Drew suggests they have a match tonight, and he's accepting the open challenge. MVP says the open challenge is open for anyone except for Drew and Braun. And then Drew strikes down Lashley, and is Lashley's held back by MVP on the floor. So certainly keeping Drew McIntyre in the immediate future for Bobby Lashley, and we would see him later tonight. But he is disqualified from the open challenge, and we would not see Braun at all tonight.
No. No, yeah, but Drew still, I mean, no real story or next opponent for Braun, you would think, unless he shows up next week. Tonight's episode, could it have used him? Yeah, maybe it could have. But what role do you see Braun having at Hell in a Cell? I don't even know if he gets a match.
Well, it's so different now. It seems like the pay-per-view strategy is, it's not like all hands on deck anymore. It's like, we're going to take a handful of programs, and then we're going to space others out for television. Like we're getting the four-way on SmackDown this week. So it's not even a
pay-per-views.
I'm not complaining about the format. I'm curious if they will. Well, I don't think they will stay with this format ultimately once they're going back to running live events. But for this next show next month, yeah, I 3-hour window is fine. Like I thought the length, I had no issues with it on Sunday. AJ Styles versus Elias. This was not Unbreakable 2005. Elias drops him in the corner, is attacking AJ's ribs. We have a big standoff with Riker on the floor as we go to commercial break. And then Elias gets hit with a big back, Elias delivers a big back body drop as Adnan Verk channels his inner Hulk Hogan from World War III, yelling, "Observe that!"
Yes.
Then he just lit his notes on fire. Styles tries for the Styles Clash. It's blocked. Elias hits the not identified symphony.
I hope they didn't drop that. I mean, I feel like pretty unanimous.
Appeal. I mean, just genius at work here. Styles sets up for the phenomenal forearm when Jackson Riker pulls him to the floor. A disqualification at 11 minutes and 47 seconds. Thanks. Great investment of my time.
Nah, I got to say this was a pretty boring match, especially for AJ Styles standards. Usually you could just count on like any AJ match, even if it was a throwaway to be.
Was this a babyface turn?
I have no idea. You had two heels facing each other here. AJ certainly wrestled the match like a babyface. You know, he was the underdog the entire time.
And Omos was booked like the babyface afterwards, where Riker almost goes after Riker, and Elias sends AJ into the steps, and then Elias hides behind the announcers.
Yeah,
so it's very much positioning Omos and AJ as the babyfaces
in a tag team match, a title contender match with Elias and Jackson Riker. So I don't know how anybody can be excited for that, but that's what we have next.
Well, I know you were excited for Alexa Bliss and her playground coming up with Tamina and Natalya. But first, Riddle is with the New Day. Riddle is talking about a two-headed snake.
Yes.
Orton appears. He assumes that is a shot at him. Orton was tricked into meeting with Riddle because he thought Adam Pearce wanted to see them. But it is Riddle trying to get New Day and Randy Orton back on the same page and suggests that Randy apologize for last week's attack. He refuses, and Kofi calls this reptile dysfunction.
Yeah.
Orton is not sorry from last week. Kofi says, I wouldn't accept your apology anyway, and warns Riddle that one of these days he's going to get an RKO. And Kofi challenges Randy to a match. Like 2009. I would have loved, like, if during the invasion we had some back and forth challenge and they were just like 1989. Let's face off tonight like 1989.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that hasn't, well, that would have happened in WCW, I think. Hey, Hogan, me and you, like 1989.
Well, then we got a confirmed listener here in Randy Orton, who Riddle goes to say something, and Orton,
he pulled it off a lot better than TJP, though, I have to say.
This was the highlight of Raw. Randy Orton, compelling character.
Yep.
Alexa's, any added thoughts here? Do you want to talk about the two-headed snake, reptile dysfunction?
No, not really. No, I just can't wait for Randy Orton to destroy everybody here.
Alexa is in her playground with Tamina and Natalya, who agreed to do this segment with them. They talk about the title win. Lily wants to know what their favorite colors are. Tamina is threatening Alexa, but Alexa says that she enjoyed watching Tamina beat up Reginald last week. And then Alexa rambles on about dead insect wings, and Natalya and Tamina walk off.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, we're fine. I mean, it's just, this is just the level we're dealing with on this show. It's, they just feel like they're like grade school type of, drama people. Like, quick, give me a character who's creepy. You know, what do they like to do? I don't know, dead bugs and flies and stuff.
Angel Garza comes out, the Lethal Lothario, and we had breaking news. Drew Gulak has theme music.
He has always had theme music, hasn't he?
Maybe on main event.
Yeah, you wouldn't know on Raw. Yeah, right.
So Garza and Gulak have their big showdown where Garza destroys this guy. He drops him, hits a double underhook backbreaker, channels his inner Otani with a face wash, and then the wing clipper for the win that is called a one-sided assault in 2 minutes and 13 seconds where Gulak got no offense in. Garza takes the rose. Graves argues he won the match. He should be able to do what he wants. And sticks the rose into Gulak's mouth as promised.
Yeah, yeah, so a bit tamer than I would say the other one. Could have been a lot worse.
What orifice do they have left?
You really want me to answer?
They gotta stretch this out.
Yeah, good choice of words.
Kevin Patrick has found R-Truth, and the 24/7 title is alive. Fear not. His title is back, everyone. He pretends he can't see. I unfortunately could. He heard there's an open challenge for his title. He's corrected. It's Lashley's open challenge. And Tozawa crawls down the stairs and rolls him up to win the title. Tozawa's back. R-Truth is back. The 24/7 title is back. It's a wonderful representation through Akira Tozawa on this show.
What kind of representation? What do you mean?
This is the Asian representation we had.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it is Asian. Isn't it like Asian Heritage Month or something?
Maybe that's why he's back. Yeah.
Right. Yes. A man playing a ninja on TV.
They put the title on him. It's big.
Yeah. I don't. They might be building to something. Who knows, dude? But like this entire show just seems to be it's got its template, and it's got its like kitchen of various finishes and various archetypes that it can insert into the show, and we're just seeing them tossed one by one. Distraction finish here. Creepy. I don't know. Supernatural creature here. We'll have a 24 segment here where Akira Tozawa will win the belt from R-Truth or vice versa here. And there's 3 hours.
Well, wait, we were only an hour in here. Randy Orton versus Kofi Kingston from 2009. Riddle and Xavier Woods are ringside. That would be key. We had a long headlock by Orton. Kingston would come off the buckle and drop kicks Randy's shoulder that he starts selling. Caught him with a power slam, but then Xavier Woods started playing the trombone. Randy could not focus. And due to the trombone, Kofi rolled him up and won in 5 minutes and 12 seconds. Byron yells, classic distraction. Kofi Kingston is your winner.
That's ridiculous. Like, they are so afraid of making Kofi Kingston look stronger than Randy Orton that they have to resort to making your baby faces cheat to win. I just don't understand that at all. I really don't. Why do you have to put him against Randy Orton then? You know? It's really tough to want to cheer for these baby faces after this.
Riddle then argues with Xavier Woods. He did not think this was on the up and up. Orton is just seething. He leaves the ring, and then Riddle shoves Woods, showing his allegiance to Randall over the New Day.
Of course he should. He cheated. Deserve that shove.
I thought warranted, yes. Pierce and Deville met with the entire women's division. Lana, Naomi, Dana Brooke, and Mandy Rose. Lana complains that people are always interfering when we get our title matches. Rose and Brooke argue, we beat Natalya and Tamina. Charlotte walks in and says, you've all blown your chances. And Dana Brooke, under her breath, says, like you did last night. What's that? Nothing. I've never seen human beings interact in this form. I have never seen something like this.
Well, these aren't human beings. They are...
superstars.
They're that. They're also just, creations on a page by a group of people. I don't think they're supposed to represent real people at all.
Like, imagine they just, like, added some, like, just, you guys have blown all your chances like you did last night. Hey, fuck you.
Yeah, I don't know how USA would feel, but I think that would be cool. Yeah.
Charlotte wants a singles match with Ripley. She explains, I was not pinned, therefore I did not lose, but she's got to beat Asuka tonight. Ripley walks in. She's ready for some new competition. Charlotte is yesterday's news. So that would be the story going into our match with Charlotte and Asuka, which would be a perplexing end. But first, we have a rematch for the women's tag titles. Tamina and Natalya against Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler. Blah, blah, blah. Shayna Baszler is going for the Kirifuda clutch, but it is stopped when the pyro goes off, blinding Reginald. And this allows... Shayna is apparently stunned by all of this. She is left prone for the heart attack, and Natalya pins Shayna in 3 minutes and 14 seconds. This is after Alexa has come out and is the one responsible for the pyro, or Lily could also take ownership of this. And Nia tends to blind Reginald, and we get laughter sound effects.mp3 throughout the arena, and the announcers are demanding help come down for Reginald. No one comes to help this man. Unsafe working environment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's technically not really I guess he is an active performer. They're on their way. They're on their way, John. I think it was Lily, because that's what the laughter was supposed to represent. It was her doing.
Okay.
So, yeah, they're going ahead with Alexa, potentially taking on either Nia or Shayna.
Or both.
Oh, sorry. Tamina or Natalya. Or it could be Shayna. I don't know.
I think it's going to be Shayna and Nia. Like, by the way, the voodoo wore off within a week, so her knee was fine.
It was it's got a radius that where it's effective. I mean, honestly, would you prefer the zombies or this?
This. I know you would choose the zombies
because at least that,
is there much that's difference? Wait, like, what are we talking the difference of? Like, Lily and the zombies. Like, what exactly is the?
I can laugh. I find some laughter in just the absurdity. But I mean, there's plenty of absurdity in this one too. None of it's really ideal, and I think it's just hilarious that we do this for a living. You know, talking about this at like 12 a.m. And this is what we do.
Man, you're broken.
No, it's just another Monday.
Seamus storms out. He says, Ricochet, I know it was you. So somebody had stolen Seamus's clothes in the locker room.
So
this is serious business because this is what precipitated Tom Billington and Jacques Rougeau's problems back in 1988. Oh, yeah. All Kurt Hennig.
Okay.
Stealing clothes. Well, destroying them.
Maybe this was a reference to that whole incident. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the promo here that Ricochet cuts is really interesting because, like, they could have just had Ricochet leave the kickoff yesterday with the clothing. But because he dropped the clothing off,
he had to re-steal them.
They had to tell us that he stole them back. So we had to have two clothing burglaries.
Yesterday was literally the dress rehearsal.
Yes. Very good.
Yeah, Ricochet's in the back. He's been accused of stealing Sheamus's jacket and hat, which Sarah Shriver says, pretty strong accusations by Sheamus. And then they showed the footage from the night prior. So I can imagine people were confused by this, that these were two separate stealings.
Yeah. He stole it twice.
Yeah.
He's just that crazy.
So then Ricochet walks off camera, and wouldn't you know it, he comes in dressed in Sheamus's clothes. He says, I feel like Ernest the Cat. It was like Ernest the Cat was handled with much more care than you in 1999. But I'm sure if you had those slippers, you could maybe tap them together like Dorothy and say, there's no place like New Japan. There's no place like New Japan. And then Ricochet does his Sheamus impression. This man is not cool, but it's this did lead to, I thought, easily the best match on the show.
I suppose so.
You were just in a disarray, man, by this point.
I just feel like, okay, here's Ricochet, and who knows if Ricochet was even supposed to be in this position, because he's probably just a replacement for Carrillo. But they have so much trouble trying to come up with a personality for this guy that they're just like trying to make him do anything. Like stealing clothes. And you got a new gimmick, Ricochet. You steal clothes.
How's your Irish accent? Pretty bad. It's pretty bad. All right. Well, it's live
and
tonight,
and we want you to dab. He's doing that now. He dabbed in the clothes. So, man, it's like, fuck, dude. Like, this is the same company that's like giving us, what is it, the Hit Row on Tuesdays? And Ricochet on Mondays, dabbing and doing Irish accents, man. It's he probably wishes he could jump back down there.
You know what is my absolute favorite part of this story, though?
What's that?
This whole story is based around Sheamus getting his gear stolen. And in the midst of this, somebody has stolen Ricochet's gear because now he's wrestling exclusively in these black jeans. He's got all this like expensive, beautiful looking tights, and he's wrestling now in jeans.
Well, that was clearly part of the problem. That's why he wasn't that over. You know, this is a new Ricochet, a street Ricochet.
So they had their match. I thought it was a really good match they had here. You had Ricochet, like, just racing around this guy. He was working, like, at an elevated speed. Sheamus is just cutting him off at different points. Ricochet scales to the top for a one-man Spanish fly and partially lands on Sheamus' leg, which didn't look fun. As Sheamus is doing all of these higher-risk maneuvers, it's he's a large man to be doing this with. But continued on, there was a springboard clothesline, standing shooting star for a two count. Quebrada lands on the knees of Sheamus, and then he misses a brogue kick going into the ropes. Sheamus then rolls to the floor, takes a high cross, and then Ricochet comes off the middle rope and is drilled with a symphony.
Yes. I think Kenny Omega should take that name.
This was like... I feel like this was supposed to be the finish. That's really what it came off as.
I think it was supposed to be the false, because that's what they used last night. And then they kept going, like, without any sort of hesitation. And I feel like it was supposed to be just the false, but...
It might have been. It didn't seem like everyone was on the same page here, because it was one of those...
The
ref
counted three.
Yeah. And then Sheamus just immediately kills him with the brogue kick and ends it in 13:29. So they went right to the finish after this. Nonetheless, I thought this was a very good match between these two.
I mean, I thought there was a pretty significant moment after the kickout, because you had Ricochet like give one final big slap to Sheamus. Almost.
That's right. He did do the defiance. Slap. You're right.
So, you know, they've gotten some good matches out of Ricochet for Sheamus over these past couple days. I do get the sense that this is just some sort of time fill as Kirill heals up. But, you know, he has taken this opportunity to remind everybody how good of a wrestler he is. And
yes, breaking news, Ricochet is a very good wrestler. He just chose a company that will be great financially for him, but creatively stifling.
They gave him a story. They gave him a bit of a new personality. I wonder how far this will go.
But then... Sheamus gets on the microphone, and in maybe the best line of this man's career, "You're not dancing now, are you, Rick O'Shea?" Dude, I love this Sheamus character. I think this guy has had like a really great run this year. I really enjoy this guy.
He's been very good, yeah.
And he indicates he might answer Lashley's open challenge. Might not.
Yeah, well... I don't know what the sign-up was like back there, because a lot of people declared their intention to come out and didn't.
Connor and Victor were in the back. They said that when they helped Lashley, it was not a gift. It was a loan. And tonight, they are coming to collect. They flip a coin for who will challenge Bobby Lashley tonight. This was a first, because one, I guess, called heads, the other called tails, and it must have landed on the middle, because neither would answer this challenge. Props to the graphics department and whoever got the Acolyte starter finger paint for T-Bar's chest here.
It's ridiculous. Like, this gimmick is just so straight out of the 80s, and... at least, like, we didn't have random animals mentioned in this promo. Like, these promos, the last time, every time we hear them from these two, it's just, like, nonsensical. I don't know what. This week, it made some sense. Except for the coin flip and not going with it.
It was a no contest, the coin flip. Didn't want
to... They were just here to flip coins. Yeah, that's the challenge. Can you flip a coin and catch it?
They didn't want to bury heads, you know? They wanted to get tails over, but they wanted to protect heads. Asuka and Charlotte Flair, the latest go-around. So Flair's in control after the break. Asuka makes this comeback. She lands a head kick that doesn't fully land. And then Charlotte has this delayed reaction to the head kick that Corey Graves notes to me... after Saturday with Shane Burgos, very realistic way to sell a shot to the head. It doesn't always pay dividends immediately. Did you see that ending to this fight?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I mean, I saw this and I saw that it looked like it didn't connect to the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
And then Charlotte, ended up like selling, like covering her mouth. So I'm not exactly sure. Like, I wonder if she might have actually... who knows what happened? Maybe she actually got hurt, or maybe not at all.
So Asuka is running through here, bulldog, sliding knee, and then the natural selection gets countered. She's going for the Asuka lock when Charlotte lands the Judas effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was kind of nice. She missed the boot but followed up with the elbow.
Then she goes to the Charlotte goes to the top with Asuka to set up for the Spanish fly. And, like, the idea that they explained was that Asuka, like, blocked it. But the way this came off was, like, Charlotte got to the top and just did a backflip onto the mat. It looked really wacky.
Well, Asuka was holding on to the turnbuckle with her feet.
If you were giving me a one-man Spanish fly, I don't think you're getting to the launch position if I'm holding on to that rope. She just rotates right over, no problem.
I'll have to try it.
Okay, we'll try that next time. They trade covers. They're just going back and forth here. Asuka's got a knee bar. Then Flair lifts her up. Asuka goes to a triangle, but doesn't get the arm over. Our latest UFC reference with Andrea Lee and Antonina Shevchenko on Saturday. Asuka lock is applied. They roll to the rope, and then Flair kicks her knee, wrenches it through the rope. Meanwhile, Rhea Ripley's been out this whole time on commentary, or just sitting there. She's not even providing commentary for us. They have a face-off. Asuka comes towards them with this back fist that comes up short. Ripley is in no danger from this back fist. And then Flair gets sent into the ropes, knocking Ripley off the apron. We go through a bunch of reversals. Charlotte tries for the figure four, and Asuka cradles her to pin her in 16 minutes and 47 seconds. So my conclusion is Rhea Ripley needs some new challengers. I have beaten Asuka multiple times. Asuka has now beaten Charlotte. I think I can move on justifiably because I have no interest in seeing these two women pursue this championship.
Yeah, this was really surprising, the end result. I actually really liked the match. I thought they carried on the same pace as last night, and I thought they worked even faster here. Building on a lot of, you know, counter for counter near falls. And it felt like, you know, like a game of like speed chess almost between two people who played with one another a lot of times. But the booking I was definitely perplexed by, because felt like the reason for the three-way with Asuka taking the pin or taking the loss, yeah, taking the pinfall, it was so that you could do a Charlotte match with Rhea Ripley. And now I don't know. Another three-way? Hell in a Cell?
Oh, my God. No, I do not want to go that direction. This was a very perplexing end. Kevin Patrick is with the alive John Morrison. Can you even attempt to explain what happened last night? It was very interesting to watch the handling of this because they are putting stock in what happened last night because The Miz is gone and the idea is something has happened to The Miz. But that was it. There was no recap of the zombies. There was just veiled references to it. And this was the extent of where we got. It was...
Morrison indicates that Miz may be changed forever. So, you would think that he'd be a zombie. But I thought Morrison would be a zombie too, because wasn't he brought down by the zombies? He seemed perfectly fine.
Maybe he had a... maybe he was wearing like, I was going to say garlic. Garlic are vampires.
Right. Yeah. What are zombies? I don't know.
He thinks that something is picking at his brain and rotting inside. The Miz might never be the same, and he's dedicating tonight's match to the memory of the Miz.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Damian Priest and John Morrison in a lumberjack match. Are lumberjacks...
Isn't this, like, did they actually announce that this would be a lumberjack match?
There was a graphic during one of the matches where they did promote a lumberjack match coming up later.
Oh, okay.
But there was no setup for it.
Isn't this hilarious? Like, you didn't have the lumberjack match last week and you saved it for tonight.
Yeah. We had the Viking Raiders, Titus, T-Bar, Mace, Cedric Alexander, Shelton Benjamin, Ali. So Ali was reunited with his former Retribution mates.
It was honestly like kind of sad because you see all these people surrounding the ring. And I think the one thing they all have in common is that I don't know how much their career aspirations are being met. I feel like everybody ringside is probably quite frustrated.
This was our follow-up appearance for Mansoor after debuting 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the return of Nikki Cross.
Yeah, it's just, by the way, Nikki Cross is here.
She's a female lumberjack.
Yeah.
She's going to throw Morrison back into the ring. She's crazy. So they had a match. Morrison tossed Tozawa into the ring, and then he runs over the barricade to do his whole parkour routine as he gets back into the ring.
I thought this really made no sense, because it was like Morrison going out of his way to run away from the ring and then jump from the crowd over top of everybody doing his parkour stuff back into the ring. When I think the idea was that he was trying to evade the lumberjacks using parkour. But he could have just rolled back into the ring in the first place. He had to avoid an opening in the ring to do all this other shit.
Well, he's vain.
He just wants any excuse to do the parkour. Yeah, I get it.
Anyway, Morrison slipped on the rope mistakenly, but then Priest got him, superplexed him to the floor. There's a rule that whenever you have a lot of people ringside, you got to do a superplex onto everybody, so they all go down like dominoes. And then Priest hit a top rope Hurricane Rana, hit the lights, and he wins in 12:08.
I thought there was a lot of effort put into like creating some cool spots. As much as the parkour didn't really work for me, I thought, you know, it was nice to see somebody try something different on a show that typically just kind of recycles matches and recycles finishes. So I appreciated that. I actually thought the suplex into the pile looked really cool. But this was a match. Oh, it was a lumberjack match.
You're right. Priest was so happy with this win, and we would find out why. Because he announced to Sarah Schreiber, it's time to move on. The Miz and John Morrison are in the past. Maybe I'll accept the open challenge tonight. I did not like the fact that you set up. I'm fine with like the heels. It's not a big deal. But the baby faces, like a Damian Priest stating that he's going to answer this open challenge and then there's no explanation for why. It just kind of made this look like, well, why didn't you answer the open challenge? There was no explanation of how this open challenge is actually answered. It's like, does everyone have a buzzer in their locker room and they have to like answer a skill testing question to get the open challenge? There was no explanation of this, but instead they just tease these baby faces showing up, and then they didn't.
Well, I like to think that there's a big lineup back there, and then whoever lines up earliest gets a spot. So either
Kofi... Well, you just gave more explanation than we got.
Either Kofi, you know, went right there after his match, or he had, like, somebody save a spot for him.
Maybe they were all lined up, and then they heard the trombone, and they were all fixated on the noise, and Kofi came out.
Could be it, yeah.
Eva Marie spot, and then Kevin Patrick is with Shelton Benjamin, who is not going to waste...
Hold on a second. These Eva Marie spots, is she supposed to be a babyface?
I don't think so. She comes off as a heel to me.
Definitely comes across as a heel, but I'm at least intrigued to see whether or not they think that this is actually the makings of a babyface character, because everything she's saying is about being inspirational, and yeah, typically that is done by heel, but it's I don't know if I'm as 100% convinced that this is going to be a heel thing.
It's so shallow, just the it's all about a perfect picture, but it's the 99 bad ones before it. I don't know, it screams heel character to me, but you know
it
what
does
it's
to anybody,
but you know, we'll find out like which MP3 will be played when she arrives at the Thunderdome.
Mm-hmm.
Shelton is not wasting any promo time on Cedric Alexander. He wants to challenge Lashley. He won't. Cedric walks in and steals the promo time, saying everyone abandons you, Shelton, because you're worthless. So Benjamin just punches him.
Yeah, so this feud continues.
It continues. Final segment, Lashley and MVP are out, and the open challenge is answered by Kofi Kingston. And that's just it. No explanation as to how this open challenge works. He's just out here. And as the bell is about to ring, MVP clarifies, this isn't for the title.
Yeah.
Non-title match. So Lashley immediately hits him with a slam. They go back and forth. Lashley hits a Judas effect. This is the most over maneuver on Raw.
I mean, really, it's just an elbow strike. Well, sure. It's...
MVP tells Lashley to get urgent, hurry up. Woods uses the trombone, and Lashley cannot resist. It's just too much, and he gets upset at Woods. Kingston flies off the apron with his DDT. SOS is countered with the spin off the shoulders, and then Kingston is sent to the floor, run into the post. He goes to do it again when Woods saves Kingston, and the referee is dealing with Xavier, telling him not to get involved. And MVP has the cane. He's going for the cane shot when Drew appears, takes the cane, and hits Lashley in the throat, allowing Kofi Kingston to roll up Lashley in 10:54. And Drew celebrates with the New Day while Lashley is fuming.
Well, I like the fresh matchup. I mean, it's going to be Lashley. And I mean, shit, we're going to see it again, I suppose, after this one, but... you would think that next time would be for the title, and I think it's nice to see Kofi being put into a prime spot. I hate the fact that they think so little of him, though, that they had to book him in cheating victories in both instances on this show. This is a guy who at one time they booked to win a gauntlet match, you know, going for an entire hour, and tonight he can barely beat these two people, Randy Orton and Lashley, without... several distractions. In this case, he had three things. He cheated three times here. He had Woods with the trombone. He had Drew McIntyre distract and Drew McIntyre using a cane. So I hate the fact that they booked Kofi Kingston to win this way. I understand wanting to make Bobby Lashley look strong, but I feel like for a babyface, you can't really have them cheat to win. And... you know, we just went through a whole month of Cesaro not being really taken seriously as a challenger. I think Kofi would have had that issue anyway, but it is so obvious he's just sort of a side character, a time-filled challenger before we get to Drew, because you have Drew standing next to Kofi on the ramp celebrating the entire time, that it's going to be really hard to take him seriously, and certainly booking like this doesn't help.
That is what I was going to say. It's that he is the Cesaro on Raw. It's the challenger to keep the champion busy, but not someone we're fully behind. I mean, that came off very apparent on this show, that you get a TV match at best out of this, that they'll probably drag on. They'll probably get Lashley and Woods, Lashley and Kingston, Lashley against both New Day members, Drew getting involved, and there we go. So that was Raw.
Oh, it was a terrible show. It was really bad.
I didn't think it was at the level of the prior 2 weeks.
I enjoyed some of the wrestling on the show, but man, like, the stories are really bad.
That's a given on this show.
They're really bad. Like, all this Alexa stuff is pretty awful. I don't know, Riddle and Orton, I await the turn, but you're... your enjoyment depends on maybe how much you could tolerate the Riddle stuff.
That pairing's fine. I think it's actually helped Riddle a lot in these segments.
It's taken him from completely unbearable to somewhat bearable. So it is an improvement. Garza and Gulak, the thing about shoving roses up people's up holes, that's one of the stories. You have Ricochet stealing clothes to get title matches. What else is on the show here? I mean, the whole thing about the open challenge, I thought was like, I understand you want to draw intrigue throughout the night, the 3 hours. Okay, who's Bobby Lashley going to face? I just feel like it in the attempt to create mystique, you made an entire roster look really bad. By, you know, claiming that they want a challenge for something and then ending up not doing it. Feels like the women's title, we're just kind of like spinning in circles with these same three challengers. And what else? What about the tag title situation? What is that?
Oh, well, that's AJ and Omos with Elias
and Riker. Like, just awful. So, and then of course you have the Lumberjack stuff. So it's a pretty pretty bad show with very little to look forward to.
Yeah, the stories are pretty much bankrupt on Raw, I would say. Let's go to the forum. Tonight's show got a 4.09, which is 4.07 higher than Way had it, on a scale of 1 to 10. And let's read what Paul from New Jersey thought. First off, the good. This is the most I've liked Riddle. The Asuka Japanese culture insert was very nice, and her match with Charlotte was very good. I didn't expect to get a clean finish. For the bad, I really felt for Natalya and Tamina. You've just won the tag titles. It's your first night on Raw, and you have to deal with the drivel of Bliss Wyatt. You would think it would be hard to forget a guy kicking a flower up another guy's ass, but I forgot until tonight. Thanks for the reminder. Angel Garza is one of my young favorites, so it's really good to see him prosper with such brilliant writing. After last night, I'm skipping anything to do with Miz and Morrison. If we were to get into the head of Alexa Bliss, do you think that she thinks what she's doing is good, or do you think that she's aware of what crap this is? It's something I've often wondered. Is she talking about her character?
I think she means the performer, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have to imagine. I think she's putting a lot of effort into it to make it work. That I could buy that after, you know, they yell cut. I could buy that she would say, oh yeah, like that was good. But
look at how much of this show is built around this. It's not like it's more of these segments. I mean, I'm sure she's being told like this, we're running with this. We're happy with this. You're playing this character just like we want it. I'm sure she's getting a lot of positive feedback to it. They would not be investing this time and effort into it if not.
Let's remember, like, Alexa was also somebody who didn't feel like she was kind of a main player for a long time, being stuck in a tag team with Nikki Cross, not really doing anything of note. So now this seems like it's a big singles push for her, where she's destined to probably clear the division with this demon character. So in that sense, I'm sure she's happy that she's getting that airtime. But creatively, is she fulfilled? I mean, who knows? Who knows what even her ambitions are? Maybe she just wants to, like, maybe she doesn't care that much. But I think we've all seen Alexa Bliss at her potential. You know, during that SmackDown title run, when she was able to, like, her presence was just so incredibly strong. And her promos were great. And her wrestling was pretty good, too. You're not seeing any of that here. You're instead seeing, I would say, some pretty cringeworthy bad writing. Badly scripted, bad horror camp every single week. So I have my opinions. I wonder how, we don't know how she feels. All right, we'll go to Roy from Rhode Island, who said, to follow up on last night's discussion about potential challengers for Roman, and given the corresponding dearth of top faces on Raw, what is Edge's current status? Is he injured, or were they just keeping him out of the way of Cesaro's push? I can't see him beating either Roman or Lashley, but what else is there for him that won't feel like a downgrade or a retread?
I don't think that Edge is going to be your regular performer. I think he's going to come in and out throughout the year. I kind of feel like you just finished that. And to me, if you were going to revisit that in the near future, you wouldn't have done the finish you did at WrestleMania.
See, Edge is somebody who I can see being very creatively, selective when it comes to what he signs up for. Like, if you were to sign up I wonder how he would do with a feud with the Fiend, but I also feel like he's not coming in for, you know, any kind of like throwaway feud with, take your pick. I don't know.
King Corbin.
Yeah. Or Apollo Crews. Like, I can't see Edge coming in for that. So I think, whatever it is, I hope it is a pairing that makes sense for the Edge character. What would this current Edge character face? Who would he face? I'd love to see Kevin Owens. I think that'd be awesome. Those two would do some great
Edge
storytelling.
Okay.
Yeah, those two would do some great storytelling together.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's interesting options. I more so look at I think with Reigns, I look at SmackDown and I sense like a show that is pretty dialed in, regarding like that is the story. The show revolves around this character, and I expect like that Roman's programs are going to have the utmost importance and as much long-term planning as you can have long-term planning in modern day WWE. Whereas on Raw, I think we're really struggling to find interesting scenarios for Bobby Lashley. It's not just finding bodies. It's also some kind of compelling stories. And again, it's just the, like, I can't tell you one story that's happening on Raw that is really grabbing my interest every week, that even in a 3-hour show, there's this story to point to that's really interesting week to week of where it's going.
See, the thing is, like, they went with Kofi tonight, and I feel like if they really wanted to, they could tell an amazing story with Kofi Kingston. That potential is there, okay? Like, the man has been without the championship for a couple of years, like, over a year now. He's been fucking around, like, doing bullshit with Riddle this entire time. How great would it be, like, to have somebody like, you know, Lashley just slap him in the face and wake the guy up and try and, you know, to make him want to get that championship back? That story, I think, would be that much more compelling than even what they're doing right now with Drew McIntyre, which is not that compelling because it's, you know, they're just repeating it so often. But we're not getting that. Instead, we're getting the Kofi Kingston who is, you know, winning via trombone and cheating. So,
well, he was 2-0 tonight with the trombone, so don't knock it.
You know what? The trombone would have really helped with Brock Lesnar, that's for sure.
They weren't thinking of that, so live and learn. All right, well, thanks, everybody. Another edition of Raw in the books. You going to rewatch it tonight?
Hey, the weather's nice, at least. You know, I can go to bed, forget about all this, and tomorrow, hopefully, it'll be sunny.
That's the thing about Raw, everybody. The sun always rises the next day. It's a brand new day, endless possibilities.
NXT looks good tomorrow.
Does look good tomorrow, yes. I'm looking forward to that cage match. That should be good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, typically, outside of Raw, I can't say there's any shows that I look at and be like, oh, no, it's this show.
Yeah, yeah. It's the first workout of the week.
Mondays are a struggle. I am not going to lie. There are few Mondays these days where I'm saying, oh, we got 3 hours tonight of Raw, mm-hmm. which is not always the case. Like, the 3 hours is what it is, but it's this last, I would say last 6-7 weeks.
Years.
Well, I think we're at a different level. This post Mania run, like, it just feels like a show.
I feel like you said that exact same sentence or had that exact same sentiment anytime Raw hits another low.
Well, I could be repeating myself. I might, but hey, that is it for us. Thanks everybody for listening. We're back on. When are we back?
We are back on Wednesday for Rwanda Dynamite. But tomorrow, join our friends at Up Next for the review of NXT and Shot in the Dark on Wednesday, also on the Up Next feed. So do check it out. And by the way, everybody, if you've been experiencing issues or at least problems downloading our shows or seeing our shows reflected quickly on Apple Podcasts, there seems to be a bug attached to the latest update to iOS. So that might be part of the reason. So we suggest maybe using another app to listen to our shows. I recommend Overcast on Apple or you can listen to us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or right at postwrestling.com. You can stream the show from there. That's probably the first place where you'll find it every single week.
You know what would be nice? Every Monday, we get this like chart email, and it always comes in like Monday afternoon. And I'll open up my email, and it'll feature like if someone's left some feedback. There's nothing worse than opening up your email and you just get to read what a piece of garbage I am. So you know what? You could be really nice. You could leave some nice feedback, and it'll make its way to my inbox next week. Leave a nice message.
Wait, who sends you stuff like that? Call them out right now. Who does that?
This is when people leave reviews,
like on iTunes.
Yes.
Oh, the iTunes are, our iTunes ratings are pretty good, actually.
It's very rare you get the negative one.
They are the ones that stand out, unfortunately. You know, it is sort of a bad habit.
They really are.
Our iTunes ratings are actually pretty strong. But yeah, leave a good one, please. Just send, make cheer this man up, okay? Please. Cheer the man up with a happy Eye to Apple review. Subscribe to us on YouTube if you're watching us on YouTube. Man, come on.
Post-wrestling on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram. You just can't get enough.
Yes, that's right. So thank you, everybody, no matter where you're listening to us, and the sun will rise tomorrow.